You are listening to The Edge, AM 1550, WURP, Braddock, Pittsburgh.
Good morning, Pittsburgh diners and travelers. Good afternoon to our overseas listeners. And again, as always, good morning to Peter.
Once again, you forgot our Australian listeners, because it's Monday already out there.
Okay.
And the
good day.
Good news is we think we're going there next February, too. So that's pretty exciting.
That's exciting. Yeah. And we have our first guest on the line. Hello. Welcome to John and Tracy Anderson.
Hello.
Hi. I'm glad both of you are on because it's a true partnership. You make and produce, you sell Woodhouse chocolates.
We do indeed. And they are luscious.
And in the Napa Valley. But you sell them all over, right?
We have our stores in Napa Valley, but yes, you can go to our website, you can call us, and we ship anywhere in the nation.
Let's jump back. You apparently fell in love with European chocolates a while back, right?
Oh, yeah. We were quite young at the time. I guess we were 18, weren't we, when we first traveled to Europe? Yeah, we were fortunate enough to spend one of our college semesters in England and became exposed to, you know, really high quality Belgian and French chocolates at that time. And somehow the others weren't the same anymore.
Oh, isn't that the truth?
There you go. We were on one of our trips, we were in Brussels.
Just before
Easter.
Oh.
And the displays in the windows around that grand, biggest of the plazas. I can't remember its name now. There was a Vittemer, I think, was the one that had the most chocolate in the window.
Amazing, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, I've never seen so much chocolate.
So you just decided that's what you wanted to do when you grow up. Huh?
Now, that's not quite true.
No, oh, okay.
It took a little while to get there.
Yeah. So tell us, now, you come from a wine family also?
Yes, my family started a winery in Napa Valley in 1971. My mother and father just simply loved wine, and that was a time when you could start a winery pretty easily.
Uh-huh.
And so they changed their lives, so to speak, and spent the next 30 years in the wine business, making sparkling wine and Chardonnay and Cabernet. And when it came time to think about doing something else, my mom wanted to retire. My father had passed away. My wife and I were running the winery with my mom. We decided to try something else, and we came back around to chocolate.
Now, is the winery still going?
The winery is. It's now called Cliff Lady Vineyard. They've changed the name of it, but he's a wealthy gentleman from Canada who's moved the winery in all kinds of directions.
Right. Now, Tracy, when did you start studying the actual chocolatiering?
Well, I don't know if it was... I took the full chef's program at the California Culinary Academy in San Francisco.
Oh, I remember
in the mid-'80s.
That, right.
And
so I wasn't
really concentrating on chocolate at that time. It was more the full deal. I don't know. I guess I sort of specialized in pastry. That was my favorite, just because I also have an art background, and it appealed to me that you could do such artistic work in pastry. It's kind of hard to make a filet mignon look artistic. And, you know, with cake, you've got pretty much a blank canvas that you can work with. And that was my first taste of working with chocolate. But then, you know, I kind of let that go for a little bit. I had children and joined the winery, and I did a lot of cooking there, but certainly not a whole lot of chocolate. Chocolate and wine wasn't fashionable at that time, you know.
Oh, really?
It certainly has become so.
Oh, certainly. In fact, we have those tastings all the time.
Oh, do you?
Oh, yeah, the chocolate and wine taster.
Well,
everybody
it's
has
fun.
That.
Well, I think the great thing for my wife was that she would blend the wines with my mother, Carol. They particularly put together our sparkling wines, and that requires an ability to take, you know, disparate flavors and build them into something better, and be able to imagine what different processes are going to do to those flavors. And that was something that really served her well when she was putting together all of our, you know, confections. She was very, very good at putting interesting, minute flavors together to make something wonderful.
Your packaging is very distinctive also. Tell us about that. That's a trendy. How long have you had that color scheme? Because that's really trendy now.
We've had the blue and white, and now we have a red and, or blue and cream, forgive me, we have a red
cream as well.
And see, I have brown and blue, which is the hot color.
Right. That's our signature color. And we put that together early on. We worked with a good designer here in Napa Valley. And in fact, we originally wanted to use a bee on our packaging, and he was the one that suggested an elephant, which only made sense to my wife. She's always loved elephants and loved Ganesh. And
I read why you have an elephant, but I can't remember.
Well, the Hinduism, they believe that the elephant is the gateway to the divine, or you know, giver of good things, wisdom, and that sort of thing.
Right. All the symbolism is good.
So we thought, why not? You know, that we some others were suggested to us that we might use some days, some pretty cute ones actually. But the elephant is the one that stuck.
Yeah, well, I ended up collecting elephants without realizing I was collecting
elephants.
Yeah,
I know. We have rabbits. We have lots of rabbits.
Yeah, all of a sudden the house was full of them.
Exactly.
I was like, oh,
well, you,
didn't mean to do that.
I guess houses fill up with elephants faster than do with rabbits.
I don't know. Rabbits
unless
are prolific.
Unless you have a very big house.
So, now that
reminds me of a joke, but we won't go there.
What distinguishes your chocolate from other chocolates? I mean, we've had some really fine chocolates on the program, like Franz and Rick Cuti, which is in your area.
Oh, very nice guy. He was very helpful to us when we started out, actually.
Oh, see, that's nice to hear.
Yes. So it is one of those businesses, I think, that, you know, chocolate makes everybody happy, and I think people working in the chocolate industry are pretty happy people.
Uh-huh.
And quite generous. Yeah, he was very nice to us. What makes our chocolate separate? John can do that.
You know, one of the things that we liked best about the European chocolates, you know, we're going into a small town or a large town, going to a chocolatier, having a piece of chocolate that you know had really just been made, getting the fresh creams in Belgium, getting the different ingredients that some of them use that don't have a shelf life. When we're used to chocolates in the United States that, while wonderful, are designed to be shipped or designed to sit on the shelf, and that limits you. You can only use certain ingredients so that they'll last for a good long time, or else you have to use a lot of preservatives. When we went into this, said we missed those fresh flavors that we got from these unique little chocolatiers. So Tracy gave herself the freedom when she designed our recipes to say, all right, I'm going to put things together that basically have no shelf life. We tell people to consume our chocolates within 7 days.
Oh,
you know, if they're going to consume them within 21 days, that's fine too, frankly. Mm-hmm. But we say 7 because it, you know, kind of puts the onus on people and they're not going to, you know, keep it for 6 months.
But does that mean you have to air freight everything?
We air freight everything.
Yeah.
And so Tracy allowed herself the gift of being able to use any ingredient she wanted to, rather than having to only select those things that have a long shelf life.
Mm-hmm.
And that allowed her to put together chocolates that we think are better, that have those unusual flavors, that have a freshness. Like when you have our fresh mint, you are really having mint that came out of our garden here in Napa Valley.
That's
wonderful.
And
Tracy works with it, and we, you know, make it, turn it into the chocolate. And if you have that fresh mint within, say, the first week, and then have that same chocolate again after it's 2 weeks old or 3 weeks old, it isn't that something has gone wrong with it, but the flavors fade. The really beautiful, unctuous flavors that you can enjoy in the first week start to disappear. So we set about, say, making what we call fresh chocolates that we get to people very quickly and give them flavors that are unique.
Now, that's pretty good for fostering demand, too, though. I guess you scarf them down in 7 days and then you have to order some more.
You got it. In fact, we actually talked
so there's a little bit of a motive in there,
larger boxes. We'll tell them, you know, get a smaller box and order again. You're better off if you, you know, just order what you need to eat now. Fortunately for most people, what they need to eat now is a lot. So that works out for us.
Now, does everything go out directly, John?
Everything is either sold from our store.
Okay.
Or you can order it from us over the phone or over our website.
And it does go directly out of our store.
And it does go directly to you.
It's not stocked anywhere.
You know, the chocolates we ship you may are certainly no more than a couple of days old when we ship them to you.
Okay. We had that difficulty, remember, with the guy in Saint-Rémy.
Yeah, I mean, we fell in love with these chocolates
We were trying to figure out how to get fabulous chocolate from Saint-Rémy in Provence, and the only thing we could think of was who would stock it, and the problem was the shelf life.
Our business wouldn't exist without overnight shipping.
There you go.
You know, we are truly an internet business. that the possibilities that the internet and overnight shipping have opened up have allowed for us to exist when we couldn't, when it would have been much harder for us to exist, say, 10 years ago.
You know, two things that got my attention were, first of all, your sea turtles, which were so cute.
Oh, thank you.
And the English toffee, which I adore and Peter can't stand. So it's the one thing we get that I can eat all of.
Oh, that's my weakness, she gets, that English
me
toffee.
Me too.
Yeah.
She gets first crack at everything. It's really funny. I kept on finding these half-consumed turtles. They would be short a leg or short two legs, and then they would be left for someone to grab the leftover. I don't know how that could have been happening.
I don't know, magic.
Well, and you know, you must rescue it and
exactly.
Finish it off, right?
And did we have your website, by the way? Did you give us the website?
Well, it's very simple, woodhousechocolate.com.
All the normal spellings,
okay. woodhousechocolate.com. Our website will come up, and in fact, right now, if you go to seasonal selections, you'll find some cute little rabbits and truffle bunnies.
Yeah, you can add to your rabbit collection there.
Add to your rabbit collection for Easter.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, you have to be careful, because some of us in the English-speaking world think that Woodhouse is spelled W-O-D-E-S.
I did that.
Right, as in PG.
Right, as in PG.
Right.
Uh-huh. Got it. Yeah.
Sorry, it's W-O-O-D here.
Yeah.
But it's the family name Wood combined with House, just because that's where you make it?
Yes. Well, not only that, but when we were deciding to use my maiden name, which is Wood, if you just stop with Wood Chocolate, that doesn't sound as appetizing.
It doesn't. No, Wood, you're right.
Yeah, I don't want to eat that chocolate made out of wood.
Right.
But I like them from Woodhouse.
Yes, that's right. You need the flow.
Yeah, now, you probably get a lot of special requests from corporations and stuff, too, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
We do all the time. It's one of the, you know, Tracy mentioned earlier that her first degree was a studio art degree. We hate to let these things out of the bag, but that's one of the things when you visit our store that you'll find are really beautifully crafted art projects out of chocolate. And we have people come in and say, I want a piano. Or I want...
Oh, really? Now, where are you exactly?
You know, I want a hippopotamus balancing on a ball, or I want these things. And so Tracy will make one for them, and they're beautiful. And then the problem is, somebody will call up and say, I saw such and such, loved it. I need 200.
That's not as easy.
and then the answer is no. I'll make two for you, but I won't make 200 for you.
Well, I mean, can you? I know, in having come out of a jewelry background, that you can have molds made. We're going to take a break. Can you hang around a little bit? We'll just take a break now.
You bet.
Great. We'll take a break.
T1 Internet access wasn't affordable to many companies as little as 2 years ago. Service providers were charging in the thousands of dollars, keeping the benefits of a T1 connection out of most companies' reach. ASP Station is now offering the faster and more reliable T1 service at a price significantly less than 2 years ago. The speed of a T1 for both sending and receiving data is simply amazing and will change the way your business runs indefinitely. You'll wonder how you ever lived without it. Call ASP Station now for details. 412-661-6001. 412-661-6001. Log on aspstation.net for more information. ASP Station, it's the way to go fast.
Call ASP Station now for details. 412-661-6001. That's 412-661-6001. Log on aspstation.net for more information. ASP Station, it's the way to go, fast.
Hi, everyone. This is Tom Rita, the networking guy and host of Pittsburgh's most unique business show, Business in the Fast Lane. We're on every Saturday morning from 12 noon to 1 p.m. right here on The Edge, 1550 a.m. For the past 24 months, we've been bringing the best and the brightest into our studios to offer you ideas, advice, and real-world examples to help you grow your business. So save those honeydews for the afternoon and join me, Tom Rita, every Saturday morning from 12 to 1 on The Edge for Business in the Fast Lane, Pittsburgh's best kept secret.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We've been talking to John and Tracy Woodhouse about their fine chocolates. And we also have Suki Jamison, Dear Suki, on the line. We're going to be doing something with the Jean-Louis Foundation and Jamison Farms Lamb. And we want to say, don't forget our website, which is on
www.onthemenuradio.com. And we already found out, Suki, that Tracy knows how to make chocolate sauce to go with lamb. Have you ever tried that?
No, I haven't, but that sounds like something I must try.
Yeah, how did she find
Tracy,
that?
Tell us what it's all about.
If she goes to, I'll start quickly. If she goes to our website and then hits news, our newsletters will come up.
Great.
And our newsletter for February of 2007 has this chocolate sauce for lamb in
wow.
it, so you
the
can get the recipe there.
Yeah.
Okay, and okay. And the website is, so we can get it in again.
www.woodhousechocolate.com.
That's it.
How about that, Suki? Next time we come up, chocolate sauce with lamb, huh?
I think it sounds like...
Now she's going to serve fish. Oh, that's a funny story, John and Tracy. Is we were going to have dinner with Suki and John at the farm, and their daughter Eliza was going to be called. And I had this... what I called a nightmare, that we got to this lamb farm and Suki greeted us and said we were going to have fish.
So
we set off, and I just missed it as a nightmare. And we get to Suki and John's, and we're selecting wines, and Suki said, what wine
fish.
Will go with fish? And I had a nightmare.
Oh, my goodness.
But that was only an intermediate course.
Yeah. Well, anyhow... keep us posted, John and Tracy, about where you're going to go with your chocolates. And everybody should come visit you because the shop's supposed to be outstanding in San Francisco.
It's in St. Helena.
When you visit San Francisco, come up to Napa Valley.
Oh, we might be doing that soon.
You want to have the wine anyway, so come on up to see our store in St. Helena. We welcome anyone.
We'll hope to see you soon.
And I highly recommend this English toffee.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks so much. John and Tracy.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Hi.
Suki, I was going to run. We have, John's not around, I understand, right?
That's right. No, he had to go to his PASA, Pennsylvania Association of Sustainable Agriculture meeting today.
Okay. Well, we recorded. Let's run, Mr. Producer. Can we run on that CD track 3 and 4? Great. We're going to do that now, Suki.
Okay. So we're going
now. I'm sure you knew I was going to say that. The reason that I'm saying that is on the menu is actually at the Jamison's Farm. Suki and John Jamison are talking to us about the Jean-Louis Paladin Foundation. John, in case somebody's been living under a rock for the past half a century, tell us who Jean-Louis Paladin was.
Great. Jean-Louis was one of the great chefs from France, and when he was here, one of the great chefs in the country. He came to Washington, D.C. in 1979, opened the restaurant. When he left France, which was the year earlier or 2 years earlier, 77 or 78, his claim to fame was that he was the youngest French chef in the country to get 2 Michelin stars. He was 28 when he got 2 Michelin stars, and the only one that surpassed him in that, if I'm not wrong, was Ducasse. So he came here in 79 and started the restaurant at the Watergate, Jean-Louis at the Watergate. He was Gascon, so he loved foie gras. So one of the first things he did when he got here was try to find foie gras. And when he couldn't find foie gras, he got Michael Gannor to start Hudson Valley Foie Gras, and also Ariane Dogan at D'Artagnan, to start that. So by doing that, he started buying from a lot of purveyors. And he had certain products that he wanted that he couldn't find in this country. And what's interesting in finding about the history of him is he did not want to import products from France. He wanted farmers and purveyors from this country to do things that were really indigenous to that area that were superior. So he ended up buying lamb from us, and we became very good friends.
I mean, it's such a huge loss, because he really did. He fathered this whole eat real, local, organic, and so forth, American products. Suki, you cooked with him. Tell us a little bit about what he was like as a personality.
Well, I saw a side of him that other people probably didn't see, because we were in the kitchen together, but not in his cooking kitchen. We were experimenting with making product, making a stew from the lamb. And he showed us the different cuts of the lamb and the, how you prepare certain ways, do certain things with the lamb to make the stew. So it wasn't under the pressure of being in a hot kitchen. So we had a really good relationship.
Everybody just speaks with such love of Jean-Louis. And he died too young, and it was a tragedy. And how did this foundation get set up?
The foundation got set up because when he was ill, all his friends, Danielle Belloud, who you interviewed a few months ago, for instance, had a dinner in New York where he raised, I think, over $200,000. And 10 or 12 chefs from New York were cooking there. We supplied the lamb. Rod Mitchell supplied fish. Michael Gnor supplied foie gras. Everybody reached out and helped to raise money for him because there was a problem with his medical insurance. So after he passed away, there were monies left, and we started a foundation. Really, his widow, Regine, was involved with that, and then other people became involved afterwards. But we started a foundation to promote what his true legacy was, as far as we were concerned, which was, as you say, joining the farmer to the chef. And the farmer is starting to be a very, very important part of what the chef does. But Jean-Louis, as you said, was doing it probably 20 years before anybody else. So it's turned out to be an interesting foundation.
And John, what exactly does the Jean-Louis Paladin Foundation do?
What the foundation does is offer internships, to young cooks or chefs, young chefs, to go to a farm or a purveyor of some sorts. It could be cheese making. It could be a lamb farm like ours. It could be, for instance, Lee Jones's place in Ohio, Chef's Garden. It could be Rod Mitchell's Brown Trading in Maine. We also had a young man go to Bordeaux last year, and we're going to have a nice lunch with the Bordeaux and him in about a month, so I'm looking forward to that. But anyway, the whole point of it is to show the young chef or cook who's been in a kitchen and is driven that there are great products rather than just good products out there to use. And that's what Jean-Louis cared about. He cared about what the product was, and he cared about the product itself. With a lot of French cooking, everyone thinks of the sauces and the this and the that, but there is a reason that the French look at things very territorially. Champagne is only champagne if it's from Champagne. And they just carry that on and on. Now, that may be kind of a strange analogy, but not really. They feel about certain areas producing products that have terroir. And that's what he was concerned with, and so that's what we're trying to promote.
You have a wonderful story about when you first delivered lamb to him. Tell us that story, John.
Yeah, he called us on a Wednesday night, and I didn't know who he was. I actually thought he was my father-in-law, who was living in France at the time, and I thought he was kidding me. But there was this very, very heavy voice that was low, very deep, and he was Gascon, which I understand is and very heavy as far as accent. I had no idea because I couldn't understand a word he said. All I heard is, and so it took me about 5 minutes to figure out what he wanted, and I was about to say, okay, jerk, that's the end of it, because I thought it was my father-in-law teasing me. But in any event, he said, I need three baby lamb for Friday. And so what happened was Suki and I got the lambs, processed them, and took them down in the back of our 1980-something Chevy station wagon, packed with ice, and we drove down to the Watergate. We had three lambs, and two of the three lambs were on my shoulders, and Suki carried another one. And we walked in the back of the restaurant, opened the door, and there was a maitre d' who was very French and very uptight and said, what are you doing here? And I said, I have three lambs for chef. And he looked at me, and I said, trois agneaux. And so then he figured out what happened. And I thought Jean-Louis was very, very old because he was so famous. And he walked in he walked back to see us, and he was about 6'2" with curly SOS hair. And he said hello and grabbed one of the lambs out of my hands and turned around and left me. And I had to put the two back somewhere else. And as he took the lamb back with him, he took it to a stainless steel work table, opened it up, took all the paper off it, and he opened it up, and he started speaking in French very, very quickly, and I couldn't understand a word he said. He called half of the staff over, and his eyes started moisting. Absolutely, he was beside himself, and he was speaking very, very quickly. And as he was speaking, I didn't know if it was good or bad, but whatever it was interesting. And so he came over to me afterwards. He said, I am very sorry, but he said, this is too much for me. I remember these lambs when I am young, and I have seen nothing like this in this country. And he was in tears. It was just wonderful.
You have such great stories here. How about before we get distracted, give us your website, anybody who wants these glorious lambs.
Yeah, it's www.jamisonfarm.com.
That's good. And Suki, you're going to tell us quickly about VHs.
When I was making the recipe for Mama Stew, which is the lamb stew I made with Jean-Louis, he had a little secret ingredient. And when he came to the United States, he found V8 juice, which is one of his secret weapons in cooking. And we use that as a product in our stew.
Oh, thank you for talking to us about this. And I want you to make sure that you've already had two interns, as I recall, and you're going to be having one soon who's going to call into the program. And we'll have to put it all together. You'll let us know.
Yes, sure will. That's great. Thank you.
So now we'll take a break.
Furnace working okay? How's your heating bills? You know, no kidding. An old or inefficient furnace can really add to the cost of keeping your home warm. If you want to keep costs down, get your furnace looked at, and I recommend Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning for that. The technicians at Bolster DeHart have been performing routine maintenance and installing high-efficiency heating and air conditioning systems in Pittsburgh since 1977. They're EPA-certified professionals who are continually factory-trained in all the latest installation and service techniques. They offer free estimates and don't even charge extra for Saturday service. They're a quality dealer you can trust. Stay warm this winter at the lowest possible cost. Call Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning at 412-367-3900. Maintenance or installation, Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning, 412-367-3900.
It's Saturday. You and your wife take the boys to the mall, straight to the food court. Your wife and Pete head for tacos. You and Danny want Chinese. You look up at the menu for a few seconds. You look down to see what Danny wants. But you don't see Danny. Your eyes dart around frantically. You instinctively call out,
Danny! Danny!
From the taco place, you hear a voice.
Hey, Dad! Change my mind!
Every parent knows that feeling when, even for a few seconds, you lose sight of your child. Imagine if he or she were actually abducted. Go to wirelessamberalerts.org. Sign up for free Amber Alerts on your cell phone. When an Amber Alert is issued in the areas you've chosen, you'll receive a free text message. If you spot the vehicle, the suspect, or the child described in the alert, call 911. Sign up today at wirelessamberalerts.org. A child is calling for help. This message brought to you by the Wireless Foundation, the U.S. Department of Justice, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and the Ad Council.
Data security and speed can be what puts your business ahead of your competition. But cost is important too. You might be paying every month for bandwidth you don't use. Let's talk about your company's disaster recovery system. Is it as effective and secure as it could be? What are you paying for your T1 line? I'll bet we can offer you a better deal. We're ASP Station, a premier independent server co-location facility and high-speed internet access provider. Virtually unlimited bandwidth, co-location for your backup servers, off-site system backup, and secure access to your equipment 24/7. Check us out on the web at aspstation.net or call us at 412-661-6001.
easy number to remember, 412-661-6001. ASP Station, 412-661-6001.
You are listening to The Edge, AM 1550, WURP, Braddock, Pittsburgh.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
It's quite remarkable. It sounds like the people who run this program actually know what they're doing. because we said we were going to interview an intern from the Jean-Louis Palandin Foundation, who's at Jemison Farms, and I believe she's actually already been listening on the line, and her name is Erica Wides. Hello, Erica.
Hi.
Hi. What are you doing on the farm? I love that farm, by the way. We still have Suki Jamison with us, listeners.
So, right, we're both on.
Yeah.
Well, I've been here a week, and so far, what have I been doing? I have been helping out a lot in the plant, helping to cut up and butcher the lambs, and I was helping a little bit with some of the slaughtering process. And I've been helping Suki out, getting her orders wrapped up and shipped because Easter is rapidly approaching and she's very busy.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just kind of doing whatever they need me to do.
Now, where did you come from?
I'm from New York.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education in Manhattan.
Oh, great. Okay.
And I've been teaching there for about 9 years.
Oh,
and,
so, yeah. So you know your stuff already.
Yeah. Well, I've been in the business for 15 years.
Yeah.
So
have you ever slaughtered a lamb before?
Nope. I had never done that.
Now, how did you?
I thought I knew my stuff, but I had never slaughtered anything, really, except maybe, you know, catching fish and, letting them flop.
Yeah. Two questions, Erica. I mean, how did you get selected for the program, and how did you choose Jemison Farms to execute it?
Well, I applied for the program. I found out about it through a man named Lee Jones.
Oh, I know Lee.
Oh, sure, yeah. He's a great guy.
Red bow tie. We know
Lee. Right, red bow tie. And I have actually been, for about the past 4 years, going to the Culinary Vegetable Institute, which is part of their teach. I teach there maybe once or twice a year for about the past 4 years. I teach there on a voluntary basis. The proceeds from my class go to help support their program called Veggie U, which is their fourth or fifth grade school curriculum, teaching, you know, kids about farm to table. And so Lee,
that's a great program, isn't it? And he's a character. He's wonderful.
Great. They're all, I love them. They're great. It's such an amazing place. Amazing.
Yeah.
Facility and product and everything. But Lee is involved with the JLP Foundation. He's on board, and he told me about it. And sort of just, you know, once a month or once a week, they send out a new product list, and slipped in the envelope was information about the internship program. And I kind of picked it up one day off of my desk and looked at it and thought, oh, this sounds really great, and then realized there was only about 2 weeks left
of
the deadline. So I very quickly got together my essay and my recommendations and all that stuff. When I looked at the choices of programs, one of them was to go work on the farm with Lee Jones, and I thought, well, that doesn't really make sense because I go there every year. One was to come and work here with the Jamisons, and the third was to go work in Maine at Brown Trading. And I have actually worked in Maine on and off throughout my career. So I thought, well, that doesn't make sense. I don't need to go to Maine. And I've always been really, really interested in lamb and goats and sheep and those sorts of animals. Sort of have this dream of one day having my own little farm and making cheese or something like that. So,
okay. So Suki, one of your contributions to the program is to actually offer an internship that people like Erica can apply for.
Right, right.
Okay.
Exactly. So that's how I chose to come and work with the Jamisons, and I had heard all about them, and I've seen their product on menus for years, and Lee couldn't, you know, say enough positive things about them, and so that's why I chose this one.
Well, I mean, you're going to learn a lot. I mean, I'm always just so overwhelmed at how much Suki knows about butchering. I mean, I just...
Yeah, she's amazing. She knows a lot, and the guys that are working in the plant know a lot, and I've just been, you know, my butchering skills have improved. I thought I was a good butcher when I got here, but now I'm really a good butcher. It's only been 4 days, so at the end of 3 weeks.
Well, how many have you done?
I don't know. I lost count.
Well, that many, huh?
Now, how long?
Well, it's more, you know, the specific parts. It's like how many legs have I done, or how many shoulders, or things like that.
So how long will you stay?
I'm staying for 3 weeks in total. The internship was, I think, for up to 5 weeks. But I can't really take that much time off of work. I have to get back to my students.
So it's up to how long? Five.
I'll be here for 3 weeks.
Yeah, but how long is it usually?
I think the award was for up to 5 weeks.
Wow.
If I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Well, I bet, Suki, I bet you can use the help, too, since Eliza's gone off, right?
That's right. Yeah, Eliza left 2 weeks ago, so this was perfect timing for me. I'm training a new Eliza, yeah.
Exactly. Eliza second.
Will you also be sharing her secrets as to how to prepare lamb dishes, Suki?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, she helped me make my barley soup this morning.
Right.
So, yeah, we do cooking once or twice a week at the plant to make our products. And next week she'll be making sausage. So she's going to take away all kinds of little secrets.
Oh,
yeah.
That's good. Thanks. Now, Suki, where can people find a list of what you actually can buy from Jamison Farm? Is it on your website?
On the website. Oh, yeah. There's a retail website, jamisonfarm.com.
Yeah, just make sure, everybody, that it's singular, because I always put an S on, and it's not.
Takes you somewhere else. Takes you to Texas or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
That's correct. Yeah, we figured somebody liked that name, and so they put an S on it and made a new website.
Oh. Uh-huh. That's nasty, isn't it?
Well, no, I mean, I naturally spelled it Jamison's Farm when I put it in there, because it's, you just take the apostrophe out. So all I have to remember is John's name is really just Jamison, and away you go.
Exactly.
And by the way, you never did ask, Suki, but we did get back. Listeners, just in case you're wondering, the second to last time ago that it snowed a lot was a night that we visited with John and Suki at the farm. We got there, and it was raining, and when we woke up the next morning, there was 6 inches of snow on the ground.
But they had a cardinal to die for. It was so beautiful, this cardinal.
Yeah, but the most important...
I wanted to have a snow day, and you guys didn't want to stay.
Well, unfortunately, we couldn't avoid the fact that we had to get back because we had something else on the menuing to do.
That's right, that's right.
There's always something else to do.
Suki, can you just... Two things. One, I just want to do a little advance notice. Have you thought any more about setting up an agritourism situation?
Yeah, we're talking about doing something like that. We have we do have people come to the farm to pick up lamb, and we've done a couple of dinners that way, and we're just, you know, in the processing stage of that.
Yeah, well, let us know so we can let people know.
And you're lined up for yet another award?
Well, we'll see what happens. Yes,
Gallo.
Indeed. We were very honored to be included in the Gallo Family Awards, and we'll see.
Yeah, that's, when did they do that? It's coming up.
I think
up.
It's around the same time as the James Beard Awards.
I think it's just before the Beard Awards, yeah. And then can you tell us, I mean, the story is, I know the story, but how did you end up raising lamb?
Oh, well, we bought an old house that had lots of acres in western Pennsylvania outside of the city, because when we moved back here in the 70s, we moved from Kansas City where we were living, and I didn't want to live in the same city where all the Jamisons lived, because they lived in Greensburg. So we moved out of town away from the city and bought an old house, and it happened to have 65 acres with it. They wouldn't sell it without the land. And so we just tried to figure out what we were going to do with 65 beautiful acres. I had two small children at that point, so we just got a few lambs for projects like 4-H, and that's kind of where it started.
Wow. And who would have ever guessed it would have been?
we call it the 4-H project that went wild.
Yeah, it did, indeed.
That's a very good description of it. But it's a wonderful experience. It's a wonderful product. We have one rack of Jamison Farms lamb left, and we just I keep on putting off cooking it because I know it's so delicious, and we're trying to figure out who to share it with.
Yeah, I keep saying, why don't we have it? You keep saying
because it's too much for two people.
not really. But anyhow, after Easter, we're gonna get a neck, and you're gonna tell us what to do with that, Suki. That's the hot new thing.
Absolutely, yeah. the newest product that all the chefs are clamoring for. So,
yeah. Suki, let's listen. You said you sent Eliza off, and she's going to a really important. She's a chef, and she's going to be working at a very important restaurant in Atlanta. And we took the opportunity to talk to her. She was a reluctant interview, but she came through. Right.
Right.
Let's listen to the tape.
We have an added opportunity here since we're at the Jamison Farm, and that's talking to Suki and John's daughter, Eliza, who is a culinary graduate from the CIA Culinary Institute of America, a chef, who's had wonderful, interesting experiences already in her young life and is about to have more. Eliza, you grew up in this amazing food-centric family on a farm. What was that like? It's a different experience than most people.
Well, when you went to culinary school, I mean, how different was it? I mean, your classmates, were they surprised? Were they impressed?
They were scared.
Why scared? Because you knew so much.
Yes.
Monosyllabic answers here, Eliza. Okay, now, you made your way easily through the CIA?
Yes, I graduated second in my class.
That, could we have a little bit of applause for that one? That's pretty good. Very modest. Your externship was where?
My externship was at Cafe Bleu in New York City.
Now, that's no minor placement there. Was the kitchen really dreadfully French?
No, it wasn't, but I learned more in 6 months there than I learned at the CIA.
Really? I mean, he's a fabulous chef, is he not? Is he strict in the kitchen?
It's very strict and very disciplined, but it's a great learning environment.
And, of course, we've interviewed him in the program, and he's also very charming when we're interviewing him. I hear he throws things.
I wasn't there for him to throw anything, so.
Okay. From there, where did you go? Well, I don't want to jump the gun here. You were at Le Bernardin?
I was at Judson Grill when I graduated, and then from there I went to Le Bernardin for 2 years.
Did you ever talk to Eric Repair?
Yes, I did. He's a great guy.
I think it's my favorite restaurant in New York City. I mean, I really just adore it.
I never ate there, but I would have loved to eat there, but I think I would eat there, most definitely.
You mean family meal? You didn't get the great food?
Family meal's a little different.
No, that's too bad. Now, I have to put this little plug in. The only meat on the Bernardin menu, as I understand it, is Jamison Farm lamb. Is that true?
They have squab as well, and now they have Kobe beef on the menu, which wasn't there when I was there.
But the lamb story is correct.
Yes.
Okay, and you moved on. You moved on to, you worked with Melissa Kelly, who we've also interviewed on the show. You were in Maine?
I was in Maine last summer for 3 months for the season, and it was another great learning experience.
And you're now off to another great experience, one of my favorite chefs, Anne Quatreau. Now, you're going to work in Bacchanalia in Atlanta?
Yes, I am next week, and I'm very excited.
How well do you know Anne and her cooking?
I ate at Canones in November when I went to the WCR conference, and I ate at Bacchanalia 2 months
ago. And what does she have now? She has a Floataway Cafe?
Floataway Cafe, Canones, Bacchanalia, and Star Provisions.
Oh, yeah, Star Provisions is a fabulous store, right? Last time I was in Atlanta, I couldn't even get, knowing her personally, I couldn't even get a reservation at a restaurant. I haven't eaten there for a while. Well, listen, Eliza, thank you for talking to us, and lots of luck. Do you want to open your own restaurant?
No.
Good for you, girl. Thanks. Oh, okay. That was fun. Suki?
Yes, that was great.
That was great. Erica, thanks for calling and talking to us. We're going to wrap this up now. We'll be back. We're going to take a break. Okay. And I'll say goodbye to you, too, and talk to you soon.
Oh, wait. Are you around for a while?
Yes.
Well, I'll call you.
Okay, great.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you. We'll take a break.
Hi, friends. I'm Phil Marcus, the host of Real Estate 101, heard every Saturday here on The Edge, AM 1550. If you've been thinking about selling your house or buying a house, I'd like to speak with you. Choosing the right agent is one of the first and most important steps in the process of buying or selling real estate. It's critical that you choose an agent who has the knowledge and experience to not only find that perfect new home for you, but to also be able to guide you step by step through the often complicated real estate process. If you don't already have a realtor, may I offer my services? I've been a real estate agent in Pittsburgh for almost 30 years. I'm a life member of the Realtors Association, and I'm proud to say that I've earned both the GRI and the coveted CRS professional designations. Won't you call me at RE/MAX Heritage? The phone number is 412-241-4200, extension 154, or my email address is phil@philmarcus.com. That's 412-241-4200, extension 154, or phil@philmarcus.com. Let's talk.
The internet is crucial to your business. Everybody knows this, but did you know Nidhogg is the company you should call for internet service? Nidhogg, personal web page hosting for less. Business web page hosting, Nidhogg offers both Unix and NT server support. Nidhogg is the company you should call for dedicated internet access. Nidhogg offers DSL for high speed, low cost, always on access. DSL is great. It means no more dial-up.
Oh, by the way, do you remember that thing called the telephone? Do you remember when people used phone lines to access the internet? Oh, I'm sorry, you still use dial-up? Well, Nidhogg does that too. Local access telephone numbers? Okay, I don't understand it all either, but I do know that I need it, and I know where to get it. Nidhogg, Nidhogg.com, 412-661-5917. That's 661-5917, or log on, Nidhogg.com. Internet the Nidhogg way.
Jazzin' Around with David J. is next on The Edge, AM 1550.
We're back. We're moving on here. We're moving south.
Well, we had a very busy, on the menu, had a very busy February and early March. We just thought we'd introduce you to one of our adventures during that time in the rest of today's program, and that was a visit to Charleston for the Charleston Food and Wine Festival. So here we are at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival, and we had the opportunity to meet a lot of very interesting people today. We just picked a couple of samples, a group of restaurants. The lead restaurant is called Magnolia's, and we met the chef of the whole group of restaurants. His name is Don, I think. So we're going to talk to Don first, and then we're going to talk to the chef at a restaurant called Boathouse. And then we're going to conclude with a slightly different note, and I'll introduce that when we get there.
On the menu is in one of the three really kind of special restaurants in Charleston. The Boathouse on East Bay is one of three restaurants, and that's where we are. And we're talking to the chef, Jason Ulak. Hello, Jason.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Let's just set the stage a little bit. If people come here, I have not been to the other, so we're going to talk about this one on East Bay, which is in Charleston proper. Tell us about the decor. I have this note saying that it's like a curved bow of a sophisticated sea-bound vessel. Tell us about that.
Well, it used to be an old warehouse, and we do have a lot of the, I guess the wood is like inside of a boat, so to speak, and it does have some of the boats hanging in the restaurant are actual boats that our owner owns or has used at one time for races and whatnot and leisure outings. So they are also hanging from the rafters in the restaurant as well. It's a very striking restaurant.
It's striking, and you can get some of this background. It's a very warm and friendly and vibrant place as well. The specialty is, of course, seafood. Before I get into your actual menu, Jason, I wanted to note that you are actually a Yank, born and bred in Massachusetts, as I understand it, and a graduate of the CIA Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park. How did you end up, you fine Yankee, coming to Charleston?
Well, a gentleman I worked with at school moved to Virginia, and then from Virginia to Charleston. And you know how he just fall in love with a Southern girl and then never left.
Aha, there's always one of those in the background. Now, you've been here a few years, but you've been to other places in the South. On your resume, you note that you're of Polish descent, and that's how you you learned to cook. You learned to cook your father's food, right? And how did you then translate from the Polish to the Yankee style to the CIA, which is French-based as well, to Southern cooking?
Well, I think cooking was in my blood. My father did a lot of cooking, holiday events with the Polish, but then when I went to school, he was open to hearing what I had to learn. So I remember one year we did an Italian-themed Christmas. So he was open to learning different things as well. And now we're like old school buddies. We trade recipes and we cook together. And he's actually a volunteer at the Food and Wine Festival this weekend.
Oh, that's fun. You didn't tell me that. I'll have to meet him. Okay, what's the menu like here? Raw bar, I noticed right away.
Absolutely. Raw bar, which includes sushi. We have some of the best sushi in town. My menu, unlike any restaurant in Charleston, we have an array of fresh fish that I buy daily. And the guests will be able to choose a specific preparation with each fish, which is, you know, sometimes it's hard to find preparation that you like with different fishes. And we also have a Hawaiian fish all the time, and we have fish as far away as New Zealand as well sometimes.
Do you actually fish yourself?
I honestly can say I do not fish.
Why did I have to ask that, right? You say you prefer fin fish to shellfish, which is surprising. Most chefs like shell.
Well, I mean, you know, lobster's lobster, and there's only, I think, you know, with shrimp and lobster, you're kind of restricted with the fin fish. It's undoubtedly a lot more open to a lot of different preparations. And I think the fin fish are kind of like people. You know, they come from all different areas and they react differently and they say different things and they tell me different things. So I treat it the same way. I treat people, the fish, pretty much.
Now, with all that said, my sheet says that your signatures are Gouda mac and cheese and Vidalia onion crusted salmon with wild mushroom grits. Tell us about the second one.
Well, the second one, trying to make a little spin on low country ingredients. But the onions are in season, and you know grits are staples in the South. So I took a piece of salmon that everyone knows and loves, and made it Southern with the onion crust on there. And mushrooms change from season to season. It has really become really popular. We sell at least 15 to 20 a night.
Well, this is exciting. We're going to have a little sushi, I understand, right now, and maybe talk later. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We had some wonderful fresh oysters and clams. We did indeed have sushi. We had a couple of other things, and that was before we set off for dinner.
Right.
And we now know where we're going next. I think we're going to the chef at Magnolia's.
Right.
We've eaten at Magnolia's, and we're pleased to be talking to its proprietor chef, Donald Barrickman. Hello, Donald.
Hello, how are you? It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we like Magnolia's, but you even have other restaurants that are on the list for us to try. Tell us about your restaurant empire here.
Well, they're on the list, on your list, and they're also right on the same block. Blossom, which opened in 1993, and Cypress.
Okay, describe the menus. What differentiates these three restaurants?
Well, Magnolia's is created more from the local flair here, local ingredients, seafood, crab, shellfish, collard greens, grits, lots of pork items, unique dishes that we've created over the years to put together an exciting menu.
You said you have some signatures that are associated with your restaurant, with Magnolia's. What are they?
Well, as opposed to foie gras, we serve chicken livers with country ham, caramelized onions, and we kick it up a notch with a veal reduction sauce. We also have our down south egg roll as an appetizer, which is stuffed with collard greens, tasso, and chicken, served with a peach chutney. Spicy shrimp and sausage, tasso gravy over creamy white grits. We also do shrimp, lobster, and scallops over grits with the lobster sauce.
Yums. How about the other two restaurants?
Blossom, we do a little more seafood with a little Italian influence. We make fresh pastas there. We do gourmet pizzas in a wood-burning pizza oven. Good emphasis on local seafood.
Now, do you have a cookbook?
I do. I've just come out with my second edition of Magnolia's Southern Cuisine. It's unique to our restaurant, all the dishes I spoke about earlier. But it's pretty much the guidelines of how to cook what we have on the menu there and the dishes that we've created over the years.
You know, the thing that's amazing to me is we can now, via the internet, put our hands on all these specialty ingredients.
You sure can. We have a website, which is www.magnolias-blossom-cypress.com. You can navigate through all three restaurants at that website.
Anything else you'd like to tell people coming to you were going to tell us about, you've lived in Charleston your whole life, except the first time it was West Virginia, and now it's South Carolina, right?
Absolutely. I had a fond attraction to the coast after traveling to South Carolina many times growing up, and wanted to be a little more closer to fresh seafood, so that's what brought me here, and Charleston seemed to be the place, so happy to be here. I like to say what we do down on East Bay Street at Magnolia's, it's where your mouth meets the South.
I love being here. Hate to leave. And we ambushed this talented young man, and thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Okay.
It's hard to believe you didn't like all the seafood from the Kanawha River in Charleston, West Virginia. But now we're going to change pace altogether because Charleston was both a food and a wine festival. And we got a pick, I think, of the wine tasting events there because we met one of the owners of Chateau Beaucastel in the wonderful Chateau Neuf du Pape region, and I had a chance to talk to him before he jetted back to France.
On the menu is sometimes very fortunate, and today has been very fortunate because we enjoyed a wine tasting of wines from Chateau Beaucastel and winemaker Marc Perrin. I caught up with him right after the wine tasting, and listeners, I wanted you to hear what he had to say to us about the Bocuse del Perin philosophy of making wines. Mark?
Yes, good morning. So I'm the fifth generation of winemaker in my family, and my family purchased Bocuse del in 1909, so it will be almost a century in we are preparing the century, I mean 100 years birthday for 2009. But Bocuse del is a very historical estate, and the first thing we know about it was in a letter that we have from the King Louis XIV, a letter to Mr. de Bocuse del. That time Mr. de Bocuse del, it was in 1680 something, was Protestant, and that was a period of the Edict of Nantes. And
now, was Monsieur Bocuse del, was he making wine then?
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, wine has been made in Châteauneuf-du-Pape for almost 2,000 years. And so he was a Protestant, and the Edict of Nantes, the king asked them to become Catholics. And so he did that, and to reward him for doing that, the king wrote him a very nice letter giving him the title of a captain of the city of Courtaisan, the coat of arms that we have on Bocuse del and all the Perrin et Fils wines is his coat of arms.
Now, because we're limited on time, because I know you have a plane to catch, let's start at the top with the wine of which you're proudest, of which the chateau is known, and then talk a little bit more about the whole family of wines that's available, if you would, Mark.
Well, what the family is known for is obviously Chateau de Bocuse del, which is one of the few Châteauneuf-du-Pape to be made out of 13 different grape varieties, so we grow all of the 13 different grapes. But maybe more importantly, we were one of the very first estates in the Rhone Valley to go totally organic. My grandfather, Jacques Perrin, did that in the 1950s. So since then, there have been no chemical pesticide or herbicides used on the vineyard. So we grow the 13 different grapes. And what is also important is that we mature them into big oak vats instead of small oak barrels. We don't use much new oak because that's not the traditional way of maturing the wine in our area. It does not work well with Grenache, and that's not our taste also.
Now, there's an American word would be grip. There's a grip about Bocuse del, which I think you said during the tasting is due to the amount of mouvedre that you put in the blend. And you said your grandfather pioneered that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, we love mouvedre. For us, it makes the best wine we can make. And for one reason, which is that we are really at the northern limit of the ripeness of the mouvedre. It's very difficult to grow mouvedre further north. And so it's difficult to achieve a perfect ripeness. But when we do so, for us, it makes the best wine we can do. And that's why we did a special cuvée called Hommage à Jacques Perrin, which is based on very high percentage of mouvedre, usually 60 to 70%.
But the wonderful part about it, listeners, is that there's a whole family of wine, starting out with Chateau Bocuse del. Mark said that retails for about $90 US. And entirely the other end of the scale, they make a Cote de Rhone, which is about $9 a bottle. It's a family of wines you need to know more about. Mark, how can people find out more about Bocuse del wines? Do you have a website that you can point people to?
Well, yes, we have a website. It's bocuse del.com, and we have a blog also that you can access from there with very updated information about the harvest, the vintages, and all these kind of things.
And that's bocuse del.com. Mark, thank you so much for talking to us, and bon voyage.
Thank you very much.
Oh, I loved him. I just thought that was the best wine tasting I ever had.
He was such a thoughtful man. That's why I really wanted to catch up with him. And he said he really had 5 minutes before he had to set off and catch his plane. Right. So he generously gave me all of it.
And when we had this wine tasting, was also so strange that some man came in and sat down next to me towards the end of the, just before we were starting the tasting. And we didn't talk much, but eventually understood that he was a chef and that he was from Philadelphia. And it turns out I asked if he knew a certain wine collector in the city who was a dear, dear friend, long since deceased. And it turns out that was his mentor. Now, what are the odds of having Arnie Byard's
protégé sitting next to me
in South Carolina in a Bocuse del wine tasting?
I know it. In Italian, it's a piccolo mondo. In English, it's a small world. In French, I'm not even sure what it is. But look out for this family of wines. They really are quite excellent. We tasted the 2000 three Bocastel, and Mark said it was closed in and sure didn't taste it to me. So this is a wine to add to your collection whenever you see it. And the website will help you to find out. And yeah, oh, we have to say goodbye now.
Right.
Till next week, listeners. Bye.
Bye-bye.